you know, when I was young around here, there wasn't really much of a film industry. So sort of getting onto some stage, working on stage as an actor seemed like just sort of a step on a journey to maybe, you know, trying to be in film and TV. And I still love, you know, I like acting because you are sort of, you give yourself over to those imaginary circumstances in full. You are on the holodeck with, you know, other artists trying to sort of just, you know, make something out of nothing. And that is a terrifying and exciting place to be. But there is something about being the shaper of the universe, you know, the entirety of it, that, you know, the builder of the holodeck, that I think just kind of comes, it's always hard. Like, writing anything is hard, but it kind of comes naturally in that, like, it's just always what I've done is sort of put one word, you know, words in a row and hopefully do it half decently. You know, I've been doing it a long, long time.
Josh McDonald is a writer for stage and screen, and not to mention one of Halifax's favorite actors. He'll join me this week to talk about his stage adaptation of I Am the Cheese, Robert Cormier's best-selling young adult novel from 1977, which will be part of Eastern Front Theater's Early Stages Festival. Josh talks about updating a 40-year-old story for the internet age, managing a lifelong career in theater, film, and television in Nova Scotia, and much more. I'm Tara Thorne, and this is The Tideline. Folks, here we are at mid-January and things remain at a standstill. Here's a hazy jam to accompany the vibe. This is Book Buddies with Dream Girl.
Doesn't matter.
Eastern Front Theater is supplementing its annual Stages Festival with a mini-festival called Early Stages, featuring four works in progress and interviews with their creatives, all streamed online for free. Coming up on January 23rd are two works, Oy Vey, My Baby's a They, which is a queer, absurd tramedy by Rooksfield Green, and Bear Theater Company's The Station, about a group of survivors taking shelter from a storm in an abandoned cable station. On January 30th, EFT will present with the Halifax Theatre for Young People a discussion of I Am the Cheese, a stage adaptation of Robert Cormier's 1977 bestseller. The playwright, Josh McDonald, has made it over from Dartmouth to join me now. Josh, hello.
Hi, Tara.
You came over from Dartmouth. You made it. It's a blustery yes, day out there.
It is a blustery day.
It's not fun. So you've adapted this book from 1977 called I Am the Cheese into a play called Hashtag I Am the Cheese.
Yes.
So clearly the internet has now come in. I guess, what is your, how did this project come to you? And what were the challenges of adapting a very best-selling, well-known story for the now times?
Mm.
That's 40 years old.
Yeah. God, it's going to take me a while to unpack that for you. Tara, do you know it at all?
I have not read it. I am not well read. I used to be, I was an English major and it went
those,
to shit.
It's kind of, it is one of those kind of canonical, you know, scholastic book order kind of books.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, it certainly was in, you know, I am 50 now. So, I mean, this, you know, I can't entirely speak to sort of what's, sort of a curriculum book now, exactly. But some of our friends and I work together as front of house staff at Citadel High sometimes in the Spatz Theater within that building. And sometimes we have breakout rooms, et cetera, that we have to get ready for various drag queens, et cetera, who are coming to visit the school and perform. And the last time I was in that library, they still do have I Am the Cheese, like, sitting there on the shelf, like I kind of purposely did a little recon to see if it is still a book that young people might know.
Right.
But it is a book that I think hit me kind of quite squarely between the eyes when I was its target age, you know, when I was sort of 12 to 14 years of age. The author of this American book is a guy named Robert Cormier. And Robert Cormier was a journalist first and foremost, but then also began writing for kids. And he's kind of like another S.E. Hinton, or a Judy Blume, or, you know, writing those kind of, the 70s had so many of those kind of books with jolly titles for kids, like, you know,
A Hero there Ain't God, Nothing But Me, Got Margaret.
100%, yeah. Or, you know, A Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich, or, you know, pardon me, You're Stepping on My Eyeball, or, you know, all of those, et cetera, right? And often underneath those titles were these fairly stark narratives, you know, these they were delivery systems for pretty grim work. And Cormier, in particular, I think because of his journalistic background, really wrote in a pretty unsparing voice. The books did not coddle. They certainly didn't talk down to kids. They were direct and fairly brutal underneath this sort of jolly sounding title, you know, I Am the Cheese. He also wrote like The Chocolate War. I don't know if that rings a bell to you. Keith Gordon made a movie out of The Chocolate War at one point. But I Am the Cheese is maybe one of the first books I ever read that did not come to a positive outcome. You know, things did not end well. And I was rattled by it. And I remembered it for a long, long time. It was my idea to pursue an adaptation for it, to let you know a little bit. And it's a tough book to sort of compress. This is going to eat our entire half hour. But the book is about a young kid. It's written in three pieces. Sort of the first person stuff is a kid saying, hi, I'm on my bike. I'm riding cross country on this odyssey to try to find my dad. Then there are these sort of very enigmatic Q&A sections that are written like they're the Watergate tapes. And this was a book circa sort of
right.
Watergate. But where the Q, this inquisitor, you don't know exactly who their identity, what identity they, who they are. And the A, you're not really sure who A is either, but somebody who is sort of bewildered and trying to answer and fumble their way to sort of, to some sort of clarity about self. And then there's these third person sections that are about a kid named Adam Farmer, who is just growing up in a small town and begins to ever so slowly kind of develop. He's a shy kid, begins a relationship with a girl in school who was played by Cynthia Nixon in a fairly shitty movie adaptation from about 1985 or 86. The movie's not great. And this kid begins to maybe eventually start to figure out that everything he's thought he's known about his own life is a lie. His identity, his parents. It's sort of not dissimilar from like Running on Empty, that that old movie, River Phoenix, Jeb Hirsch, etc. Christine Lottie. Somewhat like that. So as you read the book, these three fragmented things eventually kind of coalesce into a, you know, a mosaic picture of a fairly ominous conspiracy. And it's a conspiracy, you know, with a child at its center who realizes he's sort of about to be kind of ground down and destroyed by the powers that be. Mm-hmm. And it is, like I say, something of a Watergate parable. I think when the idea of watch out for that perhaps the powers that be don't have your best interests at heart, I think was sort of a fresher thought in 1977.
Sure.
But I thought maybe there was something interesting about that fragmented narrative where a kid is trying to sort of reassemble his identity. I thought there was something interesting about maybe trying to transpose it to now and make it more about identity theft. So there's no way to take sort of that hodgepodge narrative and deliver it exactly the same way. I thought it was kind of lens down in the play to those Q&As because they're very theatrical anyway, or filmic. You know, it is sort of the dialogue you and I are having at this table, you know, two people. But that this kid, in trying to tell us sort of about himself in my 2022 version of the play, begins to tell us sort of a story that's less about watch out for big government and more about watch out for big data, watch out for how much of ourselves we share online, offer online. And, you know, that when the powers that be know everything about you from their, you know, million data points, and you know nothing about them, that, you know, what they've been offering up to you via TikTok, via whatever, Facebook, via, you know, Snapchat, Instagram, whatever they were offering to you for free really wasn't free.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my long-winded way around saying what, and that's why sort of the ungainly hashtag at the top of the title. I think it looks better on paper than saying it's called hashtag I am the cheese. But to me, it was a quick way of expediting the fact that it is a reimagining of that narrative to talk about fairly different but no less dangerous kind of amorphous forces around us, you know, that are trying to take more and more privacy away from us, more and more control away from us.
But that's not a youth story. Was there a part of you that wanted to age it up? Or did you always kind of keep it in the high school realm?
Because it meant as much to me as a book for young adults, I wanted to continue to try to kind of talk candidly to, and again, I'm a 50-year-old guy. Can I swear on this podcast?
Yes.
Oh, wow. See, I just stammered on that. But, you know, what the fuck do I know about youth today? Exactly. I feel like I have a permission structure built into the play because my Adam Farmer, is something of a digital babe in the woods. He's been raised in almost kind of this quasi, you know, he's not literally like Amish or something, but he's been deprived of those tools and he doesn't know why.
Okay.
Makes him feel like a pariah sort of in his small town. He's like, I'm a weirdo. I don't fit in. I don't have any tech. And then eventually he sort of has the courage in order to meet, to connect, you know, to just feel like he belongs. He sort of dares to, you know, become a presence on the internet and finds that maybe he's kind of awoken the sleeping giant, you know,
mm-hmm.
to some degree. But his parents have been kind of keeping him away from these things, and they become kind of the young man's undoing. But because it was initially for young people, I thought I would want to hew to that, you know. But I would say that the reaction, you know, we were able to do this play at Stages last year, Eastern Front Theater's Stages Festival, do it via Zoom, mm-hmm. Which was not the medium that the play was meant to possess, but because it's so much about sort of, it's got so many cyber signifiers on it anyway, it did transpose fairly well. But the people who saw it did kind of question, why is this for kids. They thought it was good for kids, but they did sort of say, listen, maybe this is something that could, you know, play for different kinds of audiences, you know, from any age. The play, I reached out to Halifax Theatre for Young People when I first wrote the show, thinking this is exactly the home for this piece because it's for the very young. And then Eastern Front Theatre was the other company that said, listen, maybe we could co-produce this with Halifax Theatre for Young People because it does seem like maybe it could speak to, that it's a fairly timely story and that it might be something they could present for sort of general audiences.
Cool. So how old are the actors in it?
Sam Vigneault plays Adam Farmer, and he of course is in his, you know, he's in his 20s.
Yeah, looks young though.
He does, and God, he's terrific. The cast is amazing. Sam is a terrific Adam Farmer. When we get Sam to sort of be clean shaven and, you know, wear a pair of sort of Harry Potter-esque glasses, he looks very, very young indeed. Micah Cromwell is playing the Cynthia Nixon role, I guess I'll call it.
And also looks very young.
Yes. And then it's only a four-hander. So then...
is that what you call them after two? Did you say four-handers? This is a seven-hander.
Yeah. I don't know. I think after four, maybe you stop doing that. But
stop counting hands.
Yeah. But Susan Stackhouse, who is a terrific, truly
casual legend,
and somebody who has taught everybody else in the team, like everybody else in the ensemble, and she is something of a local legend for sure.
She's at Dow, right?
Yes, she absolutely still is. Susan Stackhouse is one of the figureheads of sort of the Fountain School for Performing Arts theater program, and Susan is playing our. I don't know that did I explain this play in any way that is coherent? But she is the Q in those Q and A's I talked about earlier. She seems exactly like sort of a very helpful psychoanalyst. So rather like a video game, often a video game's kind of paradigm, the way you are introduced to Adam in this play is he's someone who is deprived of his memories and he slowly has to sort of walk around in kind of what is a memory play and try to sort of cobble together what happened to him. Why is he deprived of his memories? Who is he? You know, he's got to answer his own five W's, but he's helped along on that journey by sort of this fairly maternal presence who perhaps is more dangerous than she seems, but it takes a while. You know, he's put all of his, Adam has invested entirely in this person helping him in a maternal kind of fashion, but she might be sort of the you know, what do they say? The steel hand and the velvet glove.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
That's what I was looking for. And then Sebastian LaBelle.
Oh, he's been on this show.
Sebastian's amazing. Yeah. And Sebastian plays the Adam Farmer's father in sort of in these kind of conjured flashbacks. It's almost in some ways, you know, like I say, it is a memory play. So it's sort of like Adam is wandering around just kind of conjuring his past for us as he sort of speaks his memories out loud to his benign inquisitor. And we get to see those things realized in front of us whilst he does so.
And did you write it as a four-hander or is that an East Coast production?
No,
reality?
Well, I think that, you know, form and function, I hope, are pretty well braided in this one. I set out to make it a four-hander for sure, but that's because I was trying to be pragmatic. I was thinking about what could we
always do
realize
we
around here. Yeah. And then, of course, even that's been relatively thwarted by COVID-19. You know, it's been incredibly hard to make a production with four people come to life.
For sure. And so this early stages production was supposed to be a live production and is now not going to be that. What is happening on this January 30th broadcast?
I do want to give kind of, very sincere shout outs and much affection to Catherine McCormick. And
never heard of her.
Elsa Pill and at Eastern Front Theater and to Tessa Mendel at Halifax Theatre for Young People and the larger team of creative artists that they've assembled to work on this show. They have been working so tirelessly, so fiercely, and with such sort of indefatigable goodwill through the holidays to try to make this happen. We were to begin rehearsals right on the other side of the holidays, like as early as January 3rd. But today, which is, what is this? Is the 13th?
Something. 16th?
Oh, God. No one even knows. Time has become a flat circle.
Every day is the same.
Yeah. But rehearsals began today. And the actors are working in order to put one foot in front of the other in the creative process of the show. But it's almost something of a research and development phase now because we're unsure how and when we can exactly deliver this to audiences due to all of the obvious realities that we're all bumbling through on
and
a daily basis.
And I imagine you wanted a school tour that may not come to fruition.
Yeah, absolutely. A play for young adults was meant to be brought to those young adults. And figuring out the delivery system's been tough. But, we are trying to figure out some manner of being able to present, even if it's maybe in a streaming fashion. Not to get in the weeds on this, though. But part of the challenge there was I had to go back to the person who has the underlying rights to the book, because, you know, they had given permission for me to adapt for a show that might be done here in my teeny tiny neck of the woods, in Nova Scotia, Canada. Not something that they necessarily would sort of be boxed up and exportable in digital fashion, right? So, you don't want to suddenly stray into what are the film rights for this rather well-known book, because they are cost prohibitive for our humble plans. But they've actually been great. The folks who have the rights are trying to be as accommodating as they can, knowing the realities that we're all facing, trying to make art for the live stage here in 2021, 2022.
Can I just say, on the point about school tours, the first time I ever saw you in my life, I was in grade 11. And you came to my school with Westray.
Yep.
and you did a Q&A afterwards, like everyone did, not just you. Yeah. And that's the only reason I remembered you. And then we got to meet, and here we are. We won't say the number of decades later.
Yeah.
Still talking.
Yeah.
That's the power of theater in the school. Do you see what it can do? Do you see the relationships it can forge?
Yeah, that's right. I remember that. I do remember.
No, you don't. You just remember my shitty school. Nancy Shrill High still looks the same.
Yep, still there. Unchanged.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so January 30th, not going to be a performance.
No, the director who, when I was celebrating all those people earlier, my singular hero for this show is Anne-Marie Kerr, who has been the director of this piece from the beginning. And Anne-Marie is a creative genius. And
yeah, I gotta get her in here. What the hell?
Oh my God. And she literally is, I think, two blocks from where we're recording right now. Not that hard to do, Tara. Anne-Marie has, all of us hate the word pivot, but has had to pivot a lot as an incredible creator of pieces for the live stage over the last year or two. Of course, she's pivoted with Aaron Collier's production of Frequencies that she directed to an online delivery system. She pivoted with a production of a play called Concord Floral that was done with the graduating class of actors at Dalhousie.
Jordan Tannehill. That would have been sweet.
Last year. And it was fucking amazing. They were both amazing for how fully they did grab on to the digital medium that was thrust upon them. Like, this was not what this was not by design, and yet they sort of surfed it and made it sort of part and parcel, part of the show. And she's been working with such tireless good humor again to try to do the same thing with I Am the Cheese. And I'm really lucky, and I'm really grateful to all of them. It's funny to be, in a lot of ways, my contribution to it is very much done. I wrote the words and then I just kind of walk away. So I almost feel some lingering guilt about them all trying to, suffer the slings and arrows of trying to make something on a daily basis during an Omicron outbreak.
Well, you bring up a good point, which is that, because I've been doing this show exclusively in the pandemic, I know when the streaming boom happened. And I am not seeing that this time. like, we come here week to week and we're like, what's the show going to be? Because nothing's happening. Yeah. Like, people have not gone back to streaming. What has your experience been with your buds in theater and film? Kind of like, do you feel like there's just sort of an active pause and we're just going to see? Like, I don't feel like people are trying to push through this time.
I would agree with that. I feel like we're just kind of balanced on some sort of knife's edge this time, thinking mm-hmm. that things, you know, that should this be sort of a hot wave that passes quickly through, that then, you know, people were beginning to sort of, Neptune was beginning to do yeah. shows for folks again, live and in person. The theater companies all around the province were yeah. doing so. And then everybody had to sort of retreat mm-hmm. again. So I feel like everybody's just kind of poised to see what happens next. And there are, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of realities with the funding bodies who have provided for these shows as well.
Yeah.
Well, not just that, but also where their expectation at least mm-hmm. was that this is for something that will happen in dimensional space in front of people. And yes, we've been accommodating, you know, the Canada Council for the Arts, et cetera, I think have tried to work with artists over the last two turbulent years. But I think at a certain point, you know, everybody just hold their collective breath for like, when can we do exactly what we said we'd do when we signed on the dotted line and mm-hmm. you gave us some money to explore, you know, this work.
Yeah. I mean, you and I saw each other at an awards show 2 months ago.
Indeed. That's right. In public.
Life was so different.
Like, were we drinking 10 pennies?
No, schooners.
Oh, schooners. How could I forget? And it was something of the people.
We were on the boats, as I like to call it.
Yes.
But you're of an interesting, and I've been finding this too. As writers, you can still work. Your thing might not get produced, but you can, but there's, you don't, the pandemic actually helps because you have no distractions. Have you been, I mean, I feel like you've been working a lot throughout this and maybe we just haven't seen it all yet.
Oh, God, that would, that could almost be the name of my biography, my autobiography. I've been working on this a lot. You just haven't seen it yet. The Josh McDonald story. I mean, like, I'm no different from anybody else in that way. But, you know, I spent so much time writing work that you try to roll it uphill, right? I mean, it's that myth of Sisyphus bullshit. Like, you try and it... it's a long, long process, and you know, you keep hoping that those things will come out the other side. It's actually, I mean, to some degree, it's why I wrote I Am the Cheese, was I thought it was easier. I do work in live theater, of course, but I also do work in film. I work in television. I had been perhaps finding my... I was flagging a bit in trying to roll those rocks uphill for film because it's a long process. And I thought, you know what, if I could, and also you've served many, many masters, as you know, Tara, you know, as well as I do, but you know, you get a lot of notes from a lot of people in a lot of places, people who you never meet, but you know, their drive by two cents often needs to be factored in somehow if you want to keep going. And that's all well and good. You know, people are putting a lot of money on the line, even on these micro budget things. It's still a lot of money. It's more money than I fucking got.
Yeah, if there was $200,000 on the floor, we wouldn't be like, ugh.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a long process. And it can be, you know, a circuitous one. And I went back to writing I Am the Cheese on purpose because I thought this might be something I could see to fruition much more easily.
Right.
And then here we are. And instead it's been, I mean, no one said any of it was going to be easy.
Yeah. But, yeah.
But I think it was kind of my way of saying, look, what could I do that, you know, something I'm passionate about, something that a story that still kind of haunts me and I think can be transposed to have some modern relevance. But also how could I get that piece of work out comparatively quickly?
10 years ago, you had two films back to back. You had Faith Fraud and Minimum Wage, originally known as Halo, starring Emma Stone's best friend, Martha McIsaac, of PEI. And you had The Corridor, shooting back to back. I had to imagine how exciting that was. Okay, first of all, both of those scripts are so different. Both of the directors were so different.
Yes, indeed.
And both of the films, obviously, very different.
Mm-hmm.
I had to imagine that you felt like you're at the top of something. How did it feel? And how did it feel after? Because, like, just hearing you talk about kind of being stuck in development, like, it must be so frustrating to know that you had it in your hand at one point.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to be shitty.
I just laugh.
It's natural, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think I just laugh at thinking that I was, ever thought I was on the top of the world about anything. I think, you know, not to be Eeyore-esque about it, but it was probably, you know, I mean, this is the best of times and the blurst of times, right? Always. It was not actually that fun to have them both. It was not by design that they would both kind of emerge at the same time, like go into production very close to the same time. And that was highly stressy.
Right, because you were working on both of them.
Oh, very much.
All the way through.
Yeah. So I wrote a play, yes. Terry, as you might recall, called Halo, yes. Which was a comedy drama about when the image of Jesus Christ seemed to appear on the side of a Tim Hortons in industrial Cape Breton. Because it
on a
really
true story.
Happened. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And for whatever reason, that was something that Two Planks and Passion Theater, who were friends and collaborators of mine, still are, of course. But I had worked with them several times as an actor, including in this Westray, The Long Way Home play that played at your high school.
I saw
it. The glamour. But they knew me. So I worked with them as an actor, but they knew me as a writer as well. And I had not written for theater. I wrote short fiction. And they thought perhaps there was a play possible in that subject matter. And I thought, what the hell, I'll give it a try. So Halo was produced a lot and traveled a lot. And so became a thing that I think Telefilm thought, oh, we could make a fairly big, quote unquote, movie out of this. And, you know, it's a play about crowd psychology in a lot of ways, because it's about how this faddish, how, you know, this rather ridiculous thing seems to take on some meaning, some importance to somebody, and begins to magnetize people from further and further away toward it, to see it, you know, to bask in sort of its Carnival Barker bullshit, or to find some meaning in it, to find some truth. That was always baked into the premise. And so it meant a lot of extras, among other things, which cost money on film. So, you know, there was a largeness to it that seemed like, you know, it needed a couple of million bucks perhaps to make. It was shot. I'd been working, you know, most of my screenwriter's life towards having a movie get made, which, you know, in my analog way was sort of a 35 millimeter film. That's sure. Just what I'd grown up with, right? So I was pleased in some ways to see that movie become in 35 millimeter, but it's almost like that kind of film stock is like running a Fabergé egg through the loom every time you call like action and cut, right? It becomes very, very, it's super expensive.
Yeah.
It also
makes. There's the money.
And it makes for a tense making experience as well, because it means that it's for all the chips. Like, you know, for the actors, you like Halo is sort of operatively or should have been a comedy drama. And a comedy, I think, you know, needs a kind of lightness. It needs, you know, it almost needs sort of that Barb and Star go to Vista Del Mar kind of like the amount of time to just goof around, like to do multiple takes, you know, bullshit around in that kind of in that Adam McKay kind of way. Halo was sort of like, we got one take at this, get it right. And like, we're going to run the camera for 7 minutes, know it like a play. It was sort of tense. It was almost kind of like a battening down to the hatches anytime we sort of shot. When Corridor came next, Corridor was shot on digital video, which was kind of a newer form at the time, for $1 million, and was with my friends. And I had my dukes up about the process. I had more things on paper that sort of said, I do have a say as a creative producer and sort of what happens to this film. I cannot be locked out of this process. And then I needed none of those qualifiers on the paperwork, because it was just my friends and we had a good time and we made something together that I think has outlived the Faith Fraud Minimum Wage movie, which is the resultant film from Halo. But like Corridor is still out there. Like Corridor, you know, and I mean, the things about that, you know, no work of art finished so much as abandoned. There are things I dearly wish I could change there too. And that's always going to be the case. I mean, it's what you said about why you direct maybe somewhat grudgingly for yourself. It's because you don't want the shit to be busted.
Yeah.
Now, you know, you're always going to quibble about some things, but I loved the creative process that Evan Kelly, who directed The Corridor, is a friend of mine, and I think he did a wonderful job. It's still not the film I would have made. That's okay. Maybe it's better. But that harmonious process coming so soon on the heels of Halo is what kept me in it.
So you have a secret part in a local film that came out this year. And you'll remember when I tell you.
Yeah,
so I have this group of friends in a group chat, and we have a number of hashtags that we go back to. And a new one that we added after seeing this film together is hashtag Josh McDonald reveal. We scream.
Do they know who I am, though?
Yes.
I mean, other than you, like, I mean,
they're all filmy people. You would know them all.
All right.
Yeah, we screamed when you appeared in that film. Again, I'm not gonna spoil it for people. I also don't think they're gonna be able to see it. I don't know actually. But how has the acting work been going? Because you've been on Digstown, you've been on the show. So you still like. Do you primarily identify as a writer or an actor, or are you just like a multi-hyphenate, like Miranda July style?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm like. What do I identify as?
Am I allowed to ask that? I'm not sure.
Oh, of course. I label myself. I think of myself as a writer. Mm-hmm. I do. Just because I've done it since I was a child. But I was attracted to acting. I went to acting school. Like I went to, you know, theater school, and I thought, you know, that was an on-ramp to sort of film and TV. You know, when I was young around here, there wasn't really much of a film industry. So sort of getting on to some stage, working on stage as an actor seemed like just sort of a step on a journey to maybe, you know, trying to be in film and TV. And I still love, you know, I like acting because you are sort of, you give yourself over to those imaginary circumstances in full. You are on the holodeck with, you know, other artists trying to sort of just, you know, make something out of nothing. And that is a terrifying and exciting place to be. But there is something about being the shaper of the universe, you know, the entirety of it, that, you know, the builder of the holodeck that I think just kind of comes, it's always hard. Like writing anything is hard, but it kind of comes naturally in that, like, it's just always what I've done is sort of put one word, you know, words in a row and hopefully do it half decently. You know, I've been doing it a long, long time.
In 2015, you and your wife, Francine DeShepherd, who I had never met in my
strange.
Life. I don't even think we've been in the same room. It's very weird.
That is strange. Hashtag you, that.
Yeah. Hashtag what? WTH. There was a rally at Province House when they cut the film tax credit, and Corey Bowles made a fiery speech, and you and Fran made a fiery speech. Do you think, looking back on that time, how do you think we're doing now? Because the government has been pushing, oh, there's more money in film than there ever has been. Laura McKenzie was here, said, no, that's not true. What's your vibe as an artist in that field?
We have been so, I had written a film that was sort of a follow-up to The Corridor that I think we were poised pretty close to being able to realize, and that was one I was going to direct myself, just at the 11th hour of sort of losing the film tax credit to the provincial Liberal government, and that project's never really recovered. But, you know, we've weathered that storm, and then you know, all of us, you know, are weathering, you know, fucking pandemics, you know, like once in 100-year pandemics to try to realize anything we do in any, you know, all different mediums, all different jobs, full stop, just living daily life. But, you know, I would not say, again, subjectively around here, it's been a great fucking decade for Nova Scotia filmmakers. We are, I think, starting to emerge. And there are more service productions, you know, coming back. It used to be sort of there was an ecology to things where, you know, you could work on the giant fucking movie and make a fair amount of cash, you know, doing whatever, you know, some, you know, from having a role down to being like a stand-in to, you know, to being below the line talent. And you could make a few bucks, you know, working for James Cameron or working for, you know, Catherine Bigelow or, you know, et cetera, around here.
Not together.
And then not together. And then turn around with some of that money and, you know, work on something with a lot of that crew, you know, would kind of cut their teeth working for the A-list Hollywood people. And it would It would sharpen their skills, and then they would turn around and use those skills on your homemade, your more DIY project. And then, you know, you also do some commercials or some voiceovers or et cetera, et cetera. You do some stage work. You know, everybody around here, I think, does try to do a little bit of everything because you're trying to cobble together a living in a weird remote place. Like, yeah. This is where, you know, I think it's not natural. We have no fucking soundstage. We're, you know, we're a hop, skip, and a jump from places like New York or L.A. It's not easy to get here. So in a way, there's no real reason that a film industry should exist here, and yet the fact that it persists is inspiring. But I would say, like, over the years where the film credit went dormant, and then kind of coming back for the, you know, for the fucking hurricane that is COVID-19 and stuff. It's, you know, the voices that are getting to an opportunity to make their work are changing as well. It's not as much of a place for me, mm-hmm. and that's okay. Fran and I are not so old as to literally want to just switch into Glide yet. But, you know, if we fucking could, we would. You know, we had sort of, you know, neither of us has a trust fund hiding in the background or anything like that. We're just kind of, you know, Fran's, you know, was literally a coal miner's daughter from Cape Breton. She and I just we're both artists, and we've sometimes wonder how the fuck we did this to ourselves. But, you know, we've lived this long using past as precedent. We survive. And, you know, we're just trying to kind of hang in there for another decade or so and then just kind of hang it up. So, you know, I've never had much of a game plan. I've never had sort of a career goals that I wanted to hit in a mercenary kind of fashion. Any day that I can spend just kind of, you know, in daydreaming with application has been a good one for me. And if sometimes somebody thinks, you know, out there, like Kat at the Eastern Front Theater, or, you know, the other folks I work with, you know, if once in a while they're like, we still think that's worth the saying or worth the doing, I'm happy for it. But I kind of, my expectations have certainly retuned themselves over the last little while. I don't expect to, you know, I'm nobody's angry young man anyway. I'm 50 years old, but also, you know, our interest in hearing from angry young men is highly diminished.
Oh yeah. 0% for me.
Sometimes I'm a jolly young man. You invited me on the show.
I did. I never considered you an angry young man.
And yet my work often was. Right? Yeah. I mean, like, Leanne, this is the worst half-hour conversation in the world. But Leanne Poole, also a mutual friend.
Yeah.
Leanne asked if I wrote a piece called Degrees. That was maybe one of the first things that I brought home from theater school, one-person show that I'd written and I was performing in and made a little movie out mm-hmm. of that, you know, was one of the first things that I think at the film festival people knew me for. I won Best Actor for it. I was very gratified. But it was about, you know, four fucking incels. You know, it was about four awful young men who just sort of idly decide to burn a homeless man alive just because they can. This is something to do. And, you know, and I am still... It's a raw piece of writing that I was very invested in when I wrote it. But Leanne, just a year or two ago, said, you know, they wanted to sort of celebrate the 25th anniversary or whatever it was of The Fringe. I might be getting the year wrong.
I think it's 30.
Certainly, 30? You certainly might be right. And she asked if I wanted to do it again or like reapproach it or sort of put it back out in the world. And I said, I don't think I do. Mm. Like, I just don't think it doesn't bear, like, I believe in it. I certainly believed in it at the time as having artistic merit, of course. But I was also like, I think it's sort of this cultural moment is past, you know, right. And there are things about it, the voices in it that I thought were accurate to young men at that time that just don't, you know, I didn't want to offer it back into the world.
So then to circle back to I Am the Cheese, do you see what I'm doing? I'm closing the circle.
An hour and 45 minutes later.
So that's also about a young man, and that's about a culture that you didn't grow up in. How did you approach actually writing that? And in terms of dialogue and stuff, did you have anyone that you ran it by? Like, if someone asked me to write for the Degrassi reboot, it wouldn't go well. Do you know what I mean?
You'd probably say yes, though.
Probably.
Yes, you would.
HBO Max? Yeah, I would. I went in for Crave.
So which voice is it you're asking about?
About like, Adam.
Just a young person?
Just about, yeah, like how do you, knowing, because you're not an angry young man, maybe you're an angry middle-aged man.
Yeah.
I'm an angry middle-aged woman. It's fine. But, you know, how did you approach actually, like, did it feel different to write a young person
with
30 years on top of it?
Oh, absolutely. I think I said in some of my babblesome comments earlier that Adam is sort of a digital babe in the woods, and so his early fumblings into the digital medium in the play, I think, give me permission for him to sound a bit not tin-eared but gormless, you know, that his slang, his spelling, etc., sort of in direct message form, etc., might be a little off because he's trying and he doesn't know any better. He is, like I say, almost he's not literally Amish, but you know, that way that he's sort of like just a kid who's sort of a digital innocent. But I think that made me feel some confidence in what I was trying to approximate. But I did also beta test. I certainly had the youngest collaborators I have out there in the world read it for me. I had young people read it for me who are not writers themselves, but just people I thought I could get to read it to see if it just, you know, passed the, passed their sniff test, as it were. And it's another reason, you know, when we talked about trying to make a piece of work come to fruition more quickly, I wanted I Am the Cheese to happen quickly because also a lot of that slang does have sort of a sell-by date.
It really does.
Yeah, and I was like, I'm going to, you know, like the play version of Halo still has, you know, sort of references, you know, has references in there that are off now, of course, because, you know, it's a 20-year-old play, but, you know, some of it's pop, and it was something that enjoyed sort of the flotsam and jetsam of pop culture, and a lot of the stuff it invokes now is itself ancient history. But so I was aware with I Am the Cheese that, you know, faster is better, like if we can kind of make this happen soon, I think it'll hit the ear correctly. But, you know, it's a flexible thing. It's a living document. And the actors working on it now, you know, help me to try to kind of keep on the right side of that stuff. You'll have to come see it, see what you think.
I'm very excited. So January 30th, you and Anne-Marie and Kat will have a chat about this whole process.
About the
and then we'll hopefully see a version at Stages for Real, which I believe is the official title. Stages for Real.
Certainly might be. I mean, yeah, so many changing variables, but sure. I think that is the plan,
okay.
Is that, you know, the play will present itself sort of in front of people in physical dimensional space.
That's all I want.
In June. But, you know, the version from Stages even last year, I was terribly proud of the artists who worked on it. And, you know, I would still, like, you know, when I have my misgivings about something like the finished product of Faith, Fraud, Minimum Wage, I don't have those misgivings with the I Am the Cheese document as it currently exists. I'm pretty pleased with that.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, that's really all you can hope for at the end of writing something. You're like, I like the thing that came out of it.
Yeah.
All right. It was so nice to talk to you.
Good luck editing this down.
It's going to be terrific. Take care. Is engineered by Palmer Jameson at the Golden Palm and produced by the Halifax Examiner.